Garrett Graff's new book about UFOs is like the one he wrote about Watergate a few years ago. He takes this huge, complicated story and just plows through it, runs down all the details. He works through the stories and the documents. The UFO book breaks down the U.S. government's attempt to understand and explain unidentified flying objects. And he says there are two threads in the book. One is the scientific search for extraterrestrial intelligence. The other one is the military's hunt for UFOs. That's the first part of the story. And Graff says that part begins on June 24th, 1947. A Boise businessman named Kenneth Arnold, an experienced rescue pilot, was flying a prop plane near Mount Rainier in Washington.
And he sees out his window nine saucer-shaped objects moving at tremendous speed. He doesn't really know what he is seeing, and he doesn't have a visual frame of reference to explain what he is seeing. There was no, at this point, history of flying saucer sightings. And so he was using words for the first time, like saucer, to describe the things that he was seeing, what they looked like, and how fast they were going. And, you know, he was estimating that they were going at hundreds of miles an hour. I mean, faster than anything that was known to fly at the time when he saw these things skipping through the sky. And he lands and tells some friends about it. It gets picked up by the media and very quickly becomes this giant national phenomenon. Over the next couple of weeks, these flying saucers take the country by storm. They are spotted in 34 states all across North America, up into Canada. Reports of these flying saucers crashing. People who are publishing what they say are photos of these flying saucers. The Roswell crash, when military officials in Roswell, New Mexico, believe that they have recovered one of these mysterious flying saucers. The nation really seemed to be invaded in the summer of 47 by whatever these flying saucers actually were. It sends the government into a panic. It sends the country into a panic. Not because anyone imagines at the time that these are extraterrestrials or that this is an alien invasion, but because this is the beginning of the Cold War. And the fear in the government is that these are not aliens, but secret Soviet spacecraft being built by kidnapped Nazi rocket scientists. This is a moment where the entire national security apparatus of the United States is in flux. Just as Kenneth Arnold is seeing these flying saucers, Congress is debating what becomes the National Security Act of 1947 that creates the modern Defense Department. The Secretary of Defense creates the National Security Council, creates the CIA, creates the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and notably creates the Air Force as a standalone branch of the military. And for the Air Force, these flying saucers were really seen as the first crisis of the independent Air Force. I think you actually see in that summer of 47 the beginning of what becomes the dominant narrative and flywheel almost of the UFO story for the next 80 years, which is these public sightings driving national security panics that then inspire attention from Hollywood and pop culture, that then in turn inspire more public sightings, that inspire new national security panics, that inspires even more fantastical Hollywood and pop culture adaptations, on and on ad infinitum, right up until the present day.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Garrett Graff has spent nearly 20 years covering national security, the war on terror, cybersecurity. So the search for alien life isn't exactly in his wheelhouse. But over the last few years, he started to notice this shift. He heard sober people in serious positions talking about UFOs. And he says the book really began in December of 2020 when he heard an interview with the former CIA director John Brennan. Brennan said he had seen some of the videos from Navy pilots that he couldn't explain, and that they could involve something that may constitute a different form of life.
And, like, that's a really startling thing for someone like a former CIA director to say.
Because he's a serious, very serious guy, right?
He's a very serious guy. And in 2020, John Brennan had just wrapped up. He's a career intelligence officer, career CIA officer, and had just wrapped up the better part of a decade as the White House Homeland Security Advisor and then the CIA director. And I figured, you know, I've covered John Brennan. I've interviewed John Brennan. There can't be that many things that puzzle John Brennan. Like, when you are CIA director or White House Homeland Security Advisor, and you wake up in the morning with a random question, there is a $60 billion a year global surveillance and intelligence apparatus that can go out and answer effectively any question that you might have. And so if John Brennan was leaving office at that point saying, man, this UFO stuff, it's pretty weird. Like, that to me really felt like a moment that was worth paying attention to.
We mentioned the story of Kenneth Arnold, what he saw in June of 1947. And I think people won't forgive us if we don't talk about the other big story that – one of the other big stories anyway that comes in the summer of 47, the story in Roswell. Would you just sort of take us through that? Because you say what happened – got people's attention then, but for years and years after that, I think it's interesting you mentioned it just kind of dies as a story, that it faded away. But take us through the Roswell part.
Yeah. So 2 weeks after Kenneth Arnold's sighting in Roswell, New Mexico, a rancher comes into the local sheriff and says, something weird has crashed on my ranch.
Right.
And the sheriff says, you know, go talk to the Air Force guys at the Roswell Army Air Force Base. Roswell Air Force intelligence officers go out, pick up the wreckage, bring it back to headquarters. And the Roswell Air Force Base in the summer of 47 is the most advanced military unit in the entire world. And the commander of the base looks at this wreckage and says, good news. We have solved this mystery of the flying saucer. For 2 weeks, everyone around the country has wondered what these things are. This wreckage must be what that thing is. And he has his public affairs officer put out a press release saying, good news, the military has recovered a flying saucer.
Right.
And then they put the wreckage on a plane to the 8th Air Force headquarters in Fort Worth, Texas. And this press release goes out, and there's about 3 hours of sort of real media frenzy. And then intelligence officers at the 8th Air Force headquarters say, you idiots, this is a weather balloon. And the 8th Air Force headquarters, you know, commander goes out and does an interview, and he says, you know, sorry, this is a terrible misunderstanding. This is not a flying saucer. This is a government research balloon. And the whole thing immediately fades away. The Roswell story, you know, lasts in the summer of 47, you know, 3.5-4 hours in this whole summer of sightings across 34 states, you know, other photographs. Like, it's just sort of part of the noise of the summer of 47, and is entirely forgotten for 30 years, really, and only comes back up and begins to achieve the public prominence that Roswell now has in the 70s and 80s as there begins to be alleged the idea that there was this big, massive government cover-up of crashed flying saucers and, you know, even recovered alien bodies. A conspiracy theory that, you know, we are still living with right up until this very moment.
Yeah.
Now, what gets complicated, and this is true of a lot of what we, you know, now recognize as UFO conspiracy theories, is that there was a government cover-up of what happened in Roswell. It just wasn't the cover-up of aliens and flying saucers. And in the 1990s, as Roswell really takes hold, the Pentagon and the Air Force come out and put out two reports trying to explain what really happened in Roswell. And they said that actually what the rancher stumbled upon was the wreckage of something called Project Mogul, which was a special research project, classified project, to develop research balloons that could fly over the Soviet Union and detect atomic blasts. And that the rancher was right to consider it a UFO. It did not look like anything that was a normal weather balloon. This was a string of about 30 balloons that stretched higher than the Washington Monument. You know, this would have been a massive crash scene when the rancher, Mac Brazel, stumbled upon it. And it was something where the Pentagon was sort of sheepishly saying, yes, we were covering up what it really was, but it wasn't really aliens.
I think it's interesting. One of the things the book does is it sort of takes us back to those early days when the military, the government is willing to say, gosh, maybe it's a possibility that this is extraterrestrial. You mentioned, for example, this project called Project Sign. And they have this research team and they do this estimate of the situation and they come up with this report. You know, they go through a lot of things, and you say in the book, it left them with only one conclusion, that this was extraterrestrial, which is amazing. But as you say, the Pentagon disagrees. They don't like it. There's this general who sort of puts an end to it. He's not buying it. And so this report as a document, as you describe, was too explosive to exist. Would you just say something about this particular moment? I think this is an intriguing time that it seems like it could be that there's going to be some sort of transparency from the military or the government to say, yeah, this could possibly be it. But then other things intervene, like in this case, a general or the Pentagon.
Yeah, and this is part and parcel in some ways that the government simultaneously across the last 80 years has continually told us there is nothing to be concerned about when it comes to UFOs, and yet also been fundamentally unable to answer the question of what are UFOs?
Right.
The Air Force ran a program for, you know, better part of a quarter century, really. It was originally called Project Sign, then it became Project Grudge, then it became Project Blue Book,
right,
where the military tried to answer what UFOs actually were. And it stubbornly found that about 20% of sightings it could not explain. You know, about 80% of what the government investigated were really easy to explain. You know, a large percentage of public UFO sightings actually just turns out to be the planet Venus, which is sort of just a really bright star in the sky that confuses people.
Right.
You know, a big chunk of public sightings end up being known astronomical, meteorological, and atmospheric phenomenon. A big chunk of them turn out to be normal military or commercial aviation. A chunk of them turn out to be a secret government development projects. You know, big chunk of public sightings in the 1950s turn out to be the U-2 spy plane, which was very much a UFO. It was a plane flying at an altitude that planes were not known to fly at, that didn't look like any plane anyone had ever seen before, flying at speeds planes were not known to fly. Yeah. In decades since, the same has been repeated with, you know, the development of the SR-71, the A-12 Oxcart, the F-111 stealth fighter, the B-2 stealth bomber, you know, and there are still these secret government projects underway that we don't really know what they are, and the public thinks are UFOs. But yeah. Even once you peel back all of those layers of classification, there's still this chunk of UFO sightings, some from very reliable and credible witnesses, that the government can't explain. The modern effort at the Pentagon is something called ARRO, the All Domain Anomalous Resolution Office. And, you know, it now estimates that it's about 2-5% of the sightings that it looks at, it still can't explain.
One of the things that you write about in the book is how the idea that we are alone in the universe is mostly this a Western idea, you say, and it's mostly a Christian idea, that there are other cultures, other religions, ancient ones, other ones that just haven't made that presumption that we're alone. Would you talk a little bit about this?
You know, one of the things, again, as we talk about the spiritual angle of the question of UFOs, you know, you come to this question of, are we alone? And are we alone is probably one of the two or three most profound and longstanding questions of humanity. You know, it is a question that you can imagine humans asking all the way back to the first time humans looked up at the sky. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a question right up there with what happens after death and is there a God? Questions that, by the way, like may not be totally unrelated, depending on what the answers to any of those things end up being. To me, what was interesting diving into this as someone coming from the sort of Western American perspective is realizing that across history and across other religions and civilizations, most, and particularly Eastern religions and civilizations, have always assumed that there is a multitude of worlds, you know, always assumed that there are other planets with other civilizations, other, you know, other people type people. And in fact, many religious traditions around the world today still hold that to be true. The modern age of, you know, UFO research that was kicked off in the 2000s was in the US backed by Senator Harry Reid, yeah, then the Senate Democratic Majority Leader. And a big part of the reason he was interested in the question of UFO studies was that, as a Mormon, his faith very much entertains the possibility of other beings and other planets teeming with life. So for him, it was much less of a jump to imagine that there were worlds and civilizations and life beyond.
Say a little bit more about Harry Reid. You mentioned that this modern era of UFO research wouldn't exist without the senator. Talk a little bit about when he comes into the picture, because you say he had kept in relatively close contact with people in and around the UFO debate. I guess it's driven in part by his, as you say, his faith, his, you know, the sort of Mormon cosmology, which takes in the possibility of these things. But then he starts talking to colleagues. Some of his colleagues in charge of appropriations, I mean, he manages to come up with, you know, millions of dollars, $22 million for this program.
Yeah, and they end up giving the funding to a Nevada businessman and entrepreneur named Robert Bigelow, right, who has an aerospace company. And through the Defense Intelligence Agency, run this multi-year effort that studies UAPs, which is the modern terminology the government uses. And Harry Reid runs this program really in secret in the Defense Intelligence Agency for a period of years, and then it is ultimately outed in reporting by the New York Times and Politico in the fall of 2017, that shows that the Pentagon is way more interested in UFOs than it actually lets on. And that becomes the moment where you begin to see, as I've said, you know, serious people talking seriously about UFOs in Washington.
Garrett Graff. His book is UFO, the inside story of the U.S. government's search for alien life here and out there. I think the question that Enrico Fermi comes up with seems to be, if not the beginning of all of this, he certainly asks a large really important question. Would you just sort of talk about this particular moment, the Fermi paradox, and where this fits in the beginnings, anyway, of the scientific search for all of this?
In the summer of 1950, Enrico Fermi is talking to Edward Teller, and anyone who has watched the movie Oppenheimer in the last year, those are going to be familiar names. They were part of the group of physicists who had helped build the atomic bomb during the Manhattan Project and were at this point in Los Alamos working on the creation of the super, the thermonuclear bomb. And that they are talking about aliens and UFOs in the summer of 1950, trying to do the math, basically, of, you know, how common is life across the universe. And basically, Enrico Fermi asks, you know, well, where are they? You know, this sort of very basic question of, if life is really common across the universe, why don't we see any of it? And it becomes the, you know, guiding question in many ways of what scientists come to call the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. If life is really common across the universe, you know, why haven't we seen any of it? Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I think gets overlooked by a lot of people in that Enrico Fermi conversation with Edward Teller is what it tells us about Roswell. And what I mean by that is, to me, the Fermi paradox is the strongest evidence that we have that absolutely nothing of interest happened in Roswell in the summer of 1947. What people generally misunderstand about how, had a spaceship crashed in the Roswell desert in the summer of 47 and been recovered by the U.S. government, the sort of popular conspiracy theory about Roswell, it has that spacecraft being taken back to Dayton, Ohio, to the Army Intelligence Center, or the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That's not where a crashed alien spacecraft in the summer of 47 would have gone. It would have gone straight up the road from Roswell to Los Alamos, which is where the U.S. government had already set up a facility to work on the most sensitive and secret projects in the U.S. government, and where it had already assembled all of the nation and world's top physicists. And so almost any way that you define it, if there were 10 people that the U.S. government had let know that it had recovered a crashed alien spacecraft in the summer of 1947, Enrico Fermi and Edward Teller would have been on that list. And so the fact that in the summer of 1950, they're standing around Los Alamos, you know, saying, well, we haven't seen any evidence of aliens yet, to me is the clearest evidence that we have that there are no grand conspiracies worth believing about Roswell.
Was there a taboo at the time among scientists about really looking into the question of extraterrestrials? Did it seem like sober, serious science, or was it seen as, you know, just an element of pop culture and silly.
Yeah, it was. There was absolutely a taboo about it. I think there still is today in many ways. I think it is a subject that people have a lot of trouble engaging with seriously because of that giggle factor. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that you're, you know, on the hunt for little green men is hard for a lot of scientists to take seriously up until fairly recently, and even to a certain extent today. You have a very small group of scientists over the last 75 years, really beginning in the 1950s and 1960s, who begin to use telescopes to look for signs of intelligent life across the universe, you know, what becomes the SETI project. And that in many ways, they try to draw very clear lines between themselves and the wacky UFO people, mm-hmm. as I say that pejoratively.
Yeah.
That Carl Sagan was simultaneously the biggest proponent of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence in the 1900s, in the 20th century, while also being one of the arch skeptics that UFOs coming here represented aliens. And interestingly, when you get into what Sagan argued, it wasn't that Sagan argued that aliens didn't visit Earth, because he argued that statistically you would expect aliens to visit Earth every 100,000 or 200,000 years.
Right. He did the calculation, basically, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this gets at, to me, one of the things that it is sort of funny about the way that we think of aliens, which is all of our first contact scenarios presuppose that aliens would find us worth visiting. You know, you have the Independence Day flying saucer over the White House, take me to your leader, alien invasion. You have the Jodie Foster contact radio message from outer space. You have the E.T. stranded lone traveler exploring Earth scenario, whereas the truth of the matter is probably no one knows we're here and wouldn't necessarily care if they did, and that aliens probably wouldn't seek out Earth because there's not that much that makes Earth all that interesting from a far distance, but that instead aliens would sort of treat Earth in the way that Sagan imagines it, which is basically as a rest stop on the New Jersey Turnpike, a place to stop off on your way from one interesting place to another. So Sagan's argument was, you know, never that aliens don't visit Earth, it's that they're not making any special effort to come to Earth, and so swing by every 100,000 or 200,000 years. And so the thing that you saw out your window last Tuesday night is statistically unlikely to be the one time in the last 200,000 years that aliens have happened to stop by Earth.
Part of the book is this kind of exploration of this intellectual argument between Sagan that you mentioned, but also another figure, J. Allen Hynek. Say more about him and where he fits in the story.
Hynek is really the prime father of ufology in the second half of the 20th century. He is an astronomer at Ohio State University when the Air Force is setting up this Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book. And has no particular interest in UFOs or flying saucers, but as he says, was the astronomer closest to the Air Force Intelligence Unit at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. So they come and knock on his door to enlist him as a consultant to help identify UFO sightings that are known astronomical phenomena. Basically, to take the first cut of UFO sightings that these intelligence officers are looking at and say, like, oh, well, you know, that was a meteor shower. That's the planet Venus. You know, we know what this thing is. We know what that thing is. And then to sort of hand the intelligence officers the, like, much smaller pile of the, like, actually interesting and potentially terrestrial-related UFO sightings. And it launches Hynek on what really ends up being a 30, 40-year intellectual odyssey, where he works with the government UFO programs across decades, goes to a lot of sightings, interviews a lot of witnesses, you know, travels the world looking at this phenomenon, and really comes to believe simultaneously that there is something real and interesting to the question of UFOs, while also believing that the government is not covering up what it knows about UFOs. That what he says at the end of his career is that, as he's retiring, is, you know, there are cover-ups of knowledge and there are cover-ups of ignorance, and that his belief is that the government across the history of UFOs has far more often been covering up ignorance than actual knowledge. That in fact, the government has no idea what UFOs are and is uncomfortable coming out and saying that.
Garrett, what did you come to understand about the person who said in public that they had seen not only bright lights or even a saucer, a craft, but had seen bodies, alien bodies? Because there's a section in the book where you write about this, the so-called experiencers. And Lonnie Zamora, a police officer, is someone that you write about. You seem kind of convinced by his story on some level. Tell his story, and what do you make of his story and others like it?
Yeah, you know, across 80 years, there are a lot of literally unbelievable UFO stories, and there are a lot of people, you know, well-meaning witnesses who were mistaken by, you know, the planet Venus or a U-2 spy plane or what have you. There is a much smaller subset of witnesses that to me stand out as particularly credible, who are people who have no obvious reason to make up an encounter with a UFO, who make no attempt to gain anything from their experience, and, you know, then just go back to their ordinary life. You know, these are people who aren't out there on, you know, the speaking circuit or trying to set up a religious cult or saying, and then the aliens stopped by my house every Thursday afternoon for tea from that point forward. Yeah. And instead, you have these people like, as you mentioned, Lonnie Zamora. This is 1964, Socorro, New Mexico. He's a small-town police officer out on patrol, chasing a speeder outside of town in the desert, and hears an explosion off in the desert and sees what he believes is an overturned car.
Right.
He turns off the road, sort of starts bumping up and down through the desert scrub to approach this. As he gets closer, he sees two figures outside of the craft. He now realizes it's a white football-shaped craft. He sees them get inside the craft and the craft take off. He's pretty shaken up by this experience, pretty traumatized by it. A New Mexico state trooper who pulls up on the scene a couple of minutes later sees him all shaken up, obviously traumatized by this, obviously confused by it. The FBI responds, the military responds, they find some circumstantial evidence of that something was in the desert at the place where he saw the craft, you know, that something had been sitting there or landed there. And then, you know, Lonnie Zamora goes back to being a small town cop the next day.
Right.
And everyone who interviews him, you know, finds him sort of credible and credulous that there is, you know, something appears to have happened to Lonnie Zamora out there in the desert that day. And we don't have a good explanation for what it was or what he saw. More recently, there we've seen in, you know, this modern era of UAPs, reports of Navy fighter pilots, Navy aviators coming forward who have had encounters with craft that they cannot explain, that have behaved in weird ways and appear to represent technology that they, the pilots, can't actually explain. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are a Navy aviator, there are a lot of reasons you don't want to be the person who comes back to the aircraft carrier and is like, man, you would not believe the UFO that I just had a dogfight with out there today.
Yeah.
You know, that's the type of thing that, like, ends your career and, you know, ends your flight privileges, you know, pretty quickly. And so, you know, we have this series of aviators and Navy pilots who have come forward. Some of them, their sightings backed up by radar or instruments or video that the Pentagon has actually released. And I think there's a lot of reasons to take these sightings seriously and treat them credibly as well.
Garrett Graff, his book is UFO, the inside story of the U.S. government's search for alien life here and out there. So what do you think we're hearing from the government today? The Defense Department announced just this month, last Friday I think it was, that it had found, you know, they sent out this report. No evidence, they said, that the government is covering up contact with extraterrestrials. And I was looking at the document. Here's something from it. It said that a consistent theme in popular culture involves a particularly persistent narrative that the government or some secretive organization within it has recovered several, you know, spacecraft and extraterrestrial biological remains, and that it's conspired. But it says that's not true. But it's a theme in popular culture. And it made me wonder, it sounds like this report that you're hearing, you know, in 2024 isn't that much different from a report you would have read in the 1950s or the 1960s. Or am I wrong? Is there, they all seem to be saying the same kind of thing.
Absolutely. This is a new report from that Aero office that has been newly created and mandated by Congress to take more seriously the UAP study. And this was a congressionally mandated report to basically look at the history of the U.S. government's involvement in UFOs and also look at some modern allegations that have come from whistleblowers and witnesses who have testified that they believe that the government is covering up, you know, a UFO study program.
Mm-hmm.
It is in many ways, as you said, a report that reads a lot like the reports put out by Project Sign and Project Grudge and Project Blue Book and a bunch of other studies and committees and commissions over the last 80 years. But to me, the most interesting aspect, and a lot of people missed this in the report, is a big chunk of the report is tracking down the programs that these whistleblowers think are UFO crash retrieval or UFO technology reverse engineering programs. And what the report says is that it tracked all of these programs down that were identified by witnesses and whistleblowers, and that all of them are not UFO related or not UAP related.
Right.
But what's so fascinating to me about that, and the thing that we've sort of never seen the government actually say before, is it admitting it has a lot of programs that look from the outside like a UFO crash retrieval or reverse engineering technology program. And so what is the government working on that outsiders in these classified circles mistake as a UFO crash retrieval program? Like that to me is actually a really fascinating question that most people are skipping over as they look at this new report from Arrow, because it's like, okay, so the government actually has some like super fantastical projects that it's working on that the intelligence community knows about, but that if you're sort of like one concentric circle or two away, you are mistaking as a UFO program. So like, what are those programs and what are they actually doing?
Right.
That's the really fascinating question that I hope people spend some time trying to dig into.
So what they're saying is, look, this isn't a program that reverse engineers a flying saucer, but it's doing something, and that something could be incredible, I guess.
Yes. And this to me is, you know, when you get to sort of the end of this subject, you know, you're left with this, okay, so what are UFOs?
Yeah.
And the answer, of course, is that there's not one thing that UFOs actually are. You know, the answer is it's going to be a bunch of different things. You know, it's a pie chart of different slices. To me, those slices probably are made up of at least four different parts. You know, one chunk of this is advanced adversary technology being tested against us. Mm-hmm. You know, advanced Chinese drones, Russian drones, Iranian drones. You know, maybe there's, you know, a Tony Stark out there in a mountain bunker working on some type of flying craft that we've never seen before. You know, some chunk of this is basically the equivalent of like sky trash and sky junk, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what we experienced, I think, last year with the Chinese spy balloon flap. Turns out if you set the NORAD radars slightly differently than they're normally tuned, you end up picking up a bunch of balloons that we don't usually see but are floating around up there. Mm-hmm. Then you get into two categories where, you know, I think we are at the very early stages of some really fantastical understanding and advances in science, which is, you know, meteorological, astronomical, and atmospheric phenomenon that we don't understand. You know, plasma and ball lightning and a bunch of other weird stuff. Then the last category to me, I think, is we have to be open to the possibility that the world and the universe is just a lot weirder than we think it is. There's going to be physics that we don't yet understand. That, to me, you know, we probably way overestimate how much of the world we currently understand. The Harvard astronomy chair, Avi Loeb, talks about this in the context of, last year, the world's oldest woman died. She was a French nun. She was 118 years old. Everything that we know about relativity and quantum physics was discovered in her single lifetime.
Right.
So, like, imagine what we are going to learn about physics in the next 100 years, or the next 500 years, or the next 1,000 or 10,000 years if humanity gets that long. You know, this could be incredibly weird stuff. You know, this could be, you know, parallel dimensions, interdimensional travel, time travel from the past or future, you know, wormholes. I mean, sort of all sorts of stuff that, like, to us right now would seem in some ways weirder than aliens, and yet might be very clear and obvious and explainable by science that we don't yet understand.
Broadly, how much do you think this is less about the possibility of aliens and more about, as you've sort of put it, the story of the people of Earth? That is, like, what did you come to understand, do you think, about humans? That we're gullible? We're not curious enough that we, you know, look for something to transfer our anxieties to? Like, what did you come down with any conclusions about that?
Yeah, that to me was actually one of the funny things about this is that the story of aliens is really more about us than it is about them, because it is a story about the limitations of our beliefs, the limitations of our imagination, the limitations of our science and understanding of the universe. And as I said, at a real basic level, a lot of the questions around UFOs and extraterrestrial intelligence presuppose that we're interesting to anyone. Whereas, all of the evidence when you get into this is that we're probably a pretty average civilization, a very young civilization in a very ordinary solar system in the outer suburbs of a pretty ordinary galaxy in a pretty vast universe. It's really hard to grasp just how tiny we actually are in the grand scheme of our universe, both in space and in time. And to me, I was left with this incredible hope and inspiration and sense of optimism about, one of the reasons that I think we should work our hardest to take care of our civilization as humans and take care of our planet right now on Earth is for the possibility of unlocking all of this science and wonder that might come with another 10,000, 100,000 million years of discovery.
Let me ask you one more question. It's the last thing you leave us with in the book, and it's this question of whether we're all more interested in the search part and the question part than the final definitive answer. And you quote one of the pilots with the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz, who had reported seeing something strange off the coast of Southern California. This was in 2004. And she said of the people that she had talked to along the way, journalists and officials and, all the other people, she said, I think they enjoy the anticipation more than actually finding answers. What do you think she meant by that? Do you think that's right?
I do think it's right, in part because this is where I'm talking about the wilds and frontiers of physics here. To me, it's quite possible that the least interesting answer to UFOs and UAPs is aliens. The wonder that I sort of felt in reporting and researching and writing this book is this sense of how these questions really connect you to the most fundamental spiritual questions of human existence. Why are we here? Do we matter? And are we alone? These are the biggest possible questions that we could be asking. And it's why I think, generation after generation, century after century, this is where humans keep coming back to.
Garrett Graff, thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Garrett Graff. His book is UFO, the inside story of the U.S. government's search for alien life here and out there. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd love to hear from you. If you have ideas or comments or feedback, you can email them at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.